Hello and welcome to Contemplations. I am joined by Thomas.
Hello.
And I am Josh, and we are here to talk to you today about postmodernism. So what we're going to do is we're going to outline basically how this kind of philosophical school of thought originates, compare it to modernism, at least in the art world. And this is kind of as an antidote to our previous conversation about aesthetics, where we didn't touch on art. So we're going to have a little delve into that, because of course modernism, postmodernism, mostly used these terms, at least in the arts, isn't it? Of course these bleed over into other disciplines as well. However, I feel like to truly understand the difference, quite at least in a way where it's very easy to see, comparing two visually different styles of creating art is a good way of going about it. And then we're going to talk about what people get wrong about postmodernism, because there are a lot of misconceptions about that. And then in so doing, we're going to basically describe it in a way where it's grounded in other things, because I think the problem with people understanding postmodernism is that they don't really, when it's talked about in the abstract, it's very difficult to pin down what it's actually getting at. But when you apply it to other things, like, oh, I see what it's doing. And that's what we're going to try and do, because if we talk about it in the abstract and the pure theory of it, then you're just going to get bogged down in lots of jargon, and it's going to be very difficult to follow. So in applying it and talking about what people might get wrong, what they might get right, we're hopefully going to explain it in a way that allows you to understand it without having to read all of the jargony gibberish that many of the postmodernists themselves wrote. And I'm sure you've got plenty of experience of reading that, because
I have. It's a lot of fun, though. You do have to engage in a lot of mental Olympics, if you like.
Yeah, so I'm going to rely on Thomas quite a lot here, because I haven't really read much in the way of postmodernism, although I feel like I have a reasonable understanding, roughly speaking, of certain parts. But you're going to be the one that's going to help fill me in about it.
I'll do my best.
Okay. So, first and foremost, the term postmodernism originates from Jean-François Lyotard's La Condition Postmoderne in 1979, which is relatively recent. So we like to think of many of the postmodernists as kind of the 1960s onwards, but of course they didn't really refer to themselves as such.
No.
I think it's only Baudrillard that actually referred to himself as a postmodernist eventually.
Near enough, yes. Not in terms of that he, not in the sense that he supported the postmodern movement, but the way he fought was within the postmodern paradigm that he lived in. As in, he developed a philosophy that was a response to what he saw as the dominance value system and all its and I suppose that the transition towards kind of like a more symbolic ends of capital rather than capital being rooted in production. That's, of course, a very high level point, which we'll get onto later, but that's what he's referring to himself as a postmodernist.
Sure. So much of postmodernism, believe it or not, is a reaction to modernism, which in itself is a reaction to traditional values of the 19th and 20th century. So it's almost two parts removed from traditional values, which is probably why it has an effect of going against these traditional values in some cases, right?
I mean, you do, funny enough, end up almost at the point where you started with postmodernism, because in trying to kind of resist kind of, I suppose, enlightenment thought, in the sense that science has this immediate access to, you know, to truth, and of course that the modernists were concerned with how that had an effect on the, you could say, the lived experiences of people who didn't, I don't know, identify or see this pursuit of scientivizing the world is a particularly good pursuit. But the postmodernists very much question that standpoint of saying, what authentic self are you actually talking about? Is it not actually true that you're just an expression, and everything you think is an expression of the dominant discourse from which you emerged? But then again, as you know, with the social justice warriors, their claims about being oppressed on the grounds of lived experience very much appeals to that classic Cartesian skeptical position. Which is very, very counterproductive against postmodern philosophy itself in many ways, but nonetheless, it's what they work with.
And I have heard that many postmodernists might describe their philosophy as presuppositionless, meaning that it doesn't presuppose any any information. I think that's basically impossible, isn't it?
It's impossible, and it's slightly egregious because the presuppositionist philosophy is Hegel's, who actually has the most powerful antidote to postmodern thought, I would say. Mm-hmm. It is presuppositionist in that it works from the position of not assuming things to be concrete and, I suppose, infinitely liquid and interchangeable. Mm-hmm.
But I think that does kind of mesh quite well with one of the fundamental aspects in that they kind of continue on that observation from Kant that we cannot know things in themselves and that our knowledge is formed by our representations of what that thing is.
Yeah, but they also assume, I suppose this applies more to the applied side of postmodernism than postmodernism per se, that the things that emerge from those social discourses are somehow irrefutable.
Mm. It seems relatively confusing to me, actually.
It is, yeah.
But more or less, this point that I'm getting at here is that they would argue that we have a limited capacity to understand the world and cannot lay claim that we know anything with absolute certainty, which I think is actually a perfectly reasonable point.
Yeah.
And I found that my contact with postmodernism when I was practicing scientific research was actually very beneficial. So it made me a lot more reflective of the role in which I had on shaping the results that I got in the end. Mm. And therefore, it made me far more considerate of limiting my own potential biases. Because, of course, we tend to go into creating things with the presupposition, if you will, that we have good intentions. Therefore, we're not going to sabotage our own work. However, unless you're taking the correct steps to mitigate your own biases, if you will, then you're always going to do this. And in knowing the limitations of the human condition, basically, as well as, you know, your own ability to seek out and create knowledge, I think is very useful. And then once you actually do have conclusions, it's always worthwhile to say, well, I'm not entirely certain whether these are correct, even if I had due diligence coming to those conclusions and adhere to all of these methodological principles, what have you, you still cannot be certain. And I think, sure, some things have more, you can be more doubtful of some things than others, and evidence isn't worthless. However, you've got to at least have some amount of skepticism because you can't know for certain that some amount of information that you've taken into consideration can't be wrong. And this is actually very powerful because it allows you to navigate the world in a way where you're never dogmatic about your own beliefs. You're always willing to entertain other ideas. And this is, at least I see, as an essential aspect of being someone in a civil society, isn't it?
Yeah.
When people are dogmatic and uncompromising about certain things that might affect other people, then there's potential there. I mean, not always, but it can be the case that causes frictions in society as we're seeing at the minute. Yeah. But then, of course, there are many things where I am unwilling to compromise. So,
yeah, particularly if you have the argument thrown at you that irrespective of your attempts to revise the concepts that you use as a scientist, the fact that you're using this discourse, this scientific discourse, means that you're never actually achieving anything in the real sense, and that the evidence that you provide, for as long as it stays within that paradigm that you're staunchly persisting with, doesn't have any more value. At least that could be the postmodern charge launched.
Yeah, and this is where me and the postmodernists kind of go separate ways, because I would say that if working within a paradigm gives something no value, then how are you going to have anything with value in the first place? Because you've always got to work within a certain framework to create knowledge in the first place.
Well, crucially, they would say that has knowledge for you, and it's an enterprise. A project that works for the benefit of you and the purpose that serves, but just not for those whom it's not for. And of course, the very idea of science being for someone and not for something else is something I would push back on heavily, of course. I think it does have a universal objective purpose and almost a moral purpose, I would say. But that would be, with strong emphasis on language, that is where you lead in terms of how their ultimate view of the world.
I mean, I can point to the fact that if you give people medicine, most of the time it works. If you put send a rocket to space, most of the time it works. I think just the actual evidence in the world that our theoretical understanding of what science has given us can apply. Of course, maybe there is, of course, the argument that, sure, we might have this understanding, but there could be another feasible explanation that isn't necessarily contradictory to that thing working and achieving its aims, but is slightly different, and therefore the science was wrong, even if the results were the same.
I think one area where the postmodernists have a genuine point on science is illustrated in Foucault's Madness and Civilization, if you heard of it, where he basically makes the claim that those people who, I suppose, we're trying to help in trying to diagnose them with mental disorders so as to kind of put them on the right path creates a corrective society that surely that for the most part comes to the detriment of those whom we're trying to help. He basically says, in short, that previously we treated people who were slightly, I don't know, quirky as just that. They're not these are not disabled people. They just act differently to us. Naturally, we went about our lives in precisely the same way, but just treated them as equals in a way that we wouldn't today, because we're not putting labels on people. Mm-hmm. But the second you start, I don't know, saying you're autistic, you've got I don't know, dyspraxia or dyslexia or whatever, you're actually denying them a form of freedom that they otherwise would have enjoyed as just an ordinary person. And these labels stick. We have institutions built around them.
Well, yes, I mean, they have legal weight as well in the psychological world.
Yes.
And I'm somewhat sympathetic to that in a way, because there's a theory in psychology known as labeling theory, where basically if someone goes to a psychologist and they talk to them for a long time, they realize they have some kind of psychological condition, and then they're diagnosed, they have this condition, they can say, okay, well, I've got this, then they in some cases people actually live up to the symptoms of the condition which they have been diagnosed, and actually become worse in getting the label.
Yeah.
I mean, this isn't true of everyone, obviously.
No.
However, I think that in giving people that label, I've quite often heard in just online conversations, I didn't really come across it in real life, but people refer to their disorders like, oh, that's just my anxiety, but that's an intrinsic part of who they are. However, in giving them a label, it allows them to compartmentalize their mental disorder and then say it's basically not a part of them just because it's undesirable. And that's a very unusual and counterintuitive to me, because you've got to take ownership over the part of yourself which you want to change. Otherwise, you're not going to be able to do that in the first place.
Yeah, and assuming abstract concepts to be true like that does indeed give those things or those diagnoses a real presence that they otherwise would not have had. Mm-hmm. I genuinely am sympathetic to the argument that what is this other than just, I suppose, just something that a structure of power that encroaches on, I suppose, your ability to be the best person that you can. Mm-hmm. I'm genuinely sympathetic to that argument.
Yeah, to kind of steel man the opposing view, of course, many of these conditions haven't been pulled out of thin air. I mean, they notice that there's a whole group of people, perhaps, that have these certain traits that are similar, and they observe these people and slowly over time develop an incremental understanding of all these different symptoms that can or cannot be essential parts. They normally identify core symptoms that, okay, if you have this condition, you will have these, and then some like additional ones that might also co-occur.
I definitely don't think that you can fully subscribe to Foucault's view in seeing every diagnosis that's ever come to exist as just something that has no objective value or is just a result of a structure of power in that sense, with no reference to something that's objectively wrong with the person. Mm-hmm. But I do think that Foucault's principle applies to many cases of depression, where a depressive mental state, I think, corresponds perhaps not necessarily to a chemical imbalance in the brain, but to things going on outside of you, which actually makes you a rational actor. Diagnosing someone as depressed who's looking at a depressing situation and being rational about it, I think is a pretty dangerous thing. But there are other disorders such as like chronic fatigue and something else I can't remember, which I think is so obscure and so abstract that you're actually doing a disservice to the people with whom you diagnose it.
The funny thing is, I've actually spoke to people who work in research in chronic fatigue, and it's one of those things where the people who suffer from it, they really, really don't want to have it. Like, it ruins their life, basically. They want basically to do whatever they can to get rid of this malaise that's weighing over them, be it psychological or not. We're still not entirely sure what causes it. However, it seems to be a very definable thing. And I think that the people who have that aren't necessarily getting anything out of being caught in that mental state or physical state. We don't actually know.
It's just, is it a misstep to assume that it's something wrong with the subject, though? That would be my question.
Well, ultimately, if there is a problem in it, and it obviously lies within the, well, at least in the case of psychological problems, it lies within the mind of the subject, then of course. I mean, if it's particularly because they're quite often the one that will seek out the psychological
help. In that case, I see it, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And just to return to a previous point, a lot of the actual conditions, they can be justified using other means rather than just, okay, basically they can test the observations using statistical testing methods to see how discrete they are from other conditions. And this is how a lot of the diagnostic manuals work, in that they compare these symptoms to other conditions and see whether there's overlap. If there's lots of overlap between other conditions, then it's not its own discrete category, and therefore it might be lumped in with other things. And you have it with things like dissociative disorders, where they're kind of a broad umbrella, and you can get more specific stuff, but you can also just get general dissociative disorder and things like that, where it's more of a generalized thing because there's lots of overlap between others. Yeah. But then people can also have more specific cases, and they try and use this mathematical measuring to complement the medical and clinical observations that they've made. And through using lots of different fields, or to use the postmodern language, to come to the same conclusion with multiple different paradigms, then they're going to strengthen their claims to finding something tangible.
That's true.
And I don't think that postmodernism necessarily takes that into account in that specific instance, but that's a very specific aspect, isn't it?
No, I think I agree for the most part.
Mm-hmm. Of course, some postmodernists also deny that scientific or historical claims can be objectively true or false at all, which is a very ridiculous claim, in my view, of course.
Well, that's they would argue that's because any testimony that you could possibly provide cannot not involve memory confabulations, for example, as in reflecting back on something, or sorry, so giving a testimony to a jury or whatever, is going to depend on what your account of that event was. And you cannot, they would argue, you can't separate that from what you would like it to be to some degree, even if that's unconscious.
Well, there's some merit, particularly in the case of memory, to saying that the environmental criteria of recalling the memory shapes how you recall it, and it's why you can get false memories and things like that. However, there are cases where people's memory recall has been so specific that they've been able to catch someone that otherwise they wouldn't be able to. So it's very contingent. I think it's oversimplifying something that's a lot more complex, basically.
It is. And well, that their conclusion would be that all you can ultimately have in a series of testimonies referring to even if they're referring to exactly the same event, are just referentials of different referentials that ultimately doesn't grasp the pure quality of the thing that's being discussed, and thus any claim to that thing just withers away the more you try to describe it. But of course, isn't a very helpful way of dealing with something concerned with justice.
Yeah, and just to kind of focus on that referential aspect, what the postmodernists mean by that in the referential thing is that you make reference to something which in turn references something else, and it's like an endless chain of referencing. However, I feel like that loses the fact that this still carries meaning and people understand what you mean. It's not like you don't understand the words I'm saying, just because they're referential in their nature and their meaning. Most people understand the world around them through reference, through prior experience, more or less.
Yeah.
That's basically what it means. And I mean, how else could you have any information?
Well, that's the thing. I think that they're almost caricaturing what scientists have always understood or objective reality to be, as in they're not like scientists, unless they're extremely dogmatic, at least don't tend to see objective knowledge as kind of equitable to knowing the thing or being the thing, because that would be absurd. It's kind of using an indexical points of reference to understand something about it and to kind of assess that through different ways to ensure that index actually carries some weight. That's the postmodernists don't seem to think that only applies to people whose social group operates within that reference and doesn't apply anywhere else. Mm-hmm. And that's, needless to say, I think is pretty absurd and ambitious.
Yeah. So they go even further than denying that science or historical claims can be true or false. And they also deny that science and technology inevitably change society for the better, which, to be fair, I can understand in many cases, in that there are some technologies and scientific discoveries that may not change society for the better.
Yeah.
And I mean, many people argue this, particularly on our side of politics, mm-hmm. about a whole host of things. Like, the metaverse is a technological change,
yes.
and development. Is that going to change society for the better?
Certainly not.
Yeah, living in a virtual reality at the cost of your own actual reality, I think perhaps there will be some positives to it, but on the whole, I think it's going to detract from your actual life.
Certainly see how something like this would be appealing to the nihilists, given that it opens up the possibility that the second we can just put ourselves in comas where we can where we don't need to eat or drink, the virtual world is our oyster. We can be F1 drivers in a virtual universe for the rest of our lives, and not have to ever come out of that universe to see the brute reality that we're. Of what we are ultimately. But there are postmodernists, I must say, one of whom is Baudrillard, who are deeply, deeply, I would say, even though he doesn't actually say this explicitly, afraid of the technological direction that we're heading in, and actually think that technology has a causal hold over the direction that we're going. Mm-hmm. And a lot of his writings, particularly in Simulacra and Simulation, which I would encourage anyone to read, you can actually pick up on this despairing tone that he glosses over with by explaining the situations in irony, such as what's it called, JB Ballard's Crash, where he basically tries to unpack the nature of the simulation and to explain that we're just heading towards a scenario where human beings aren't really acting as self-determining governing agents in the sense that we used to. The second we give up on reason as an idea and almost accept the postmodern idea that reason has always been a referential of another referential, you end up at the point only responding to social signifiers, and then our moral behaviour has ultimately no content, and thus we become instrumentalised almost like a car, to the point where we have crashes for the sake of just trying to pursue some engineering excellence, such as, like, I don't know, speed or whatever, and that in itself becomes virtue.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.